Welcome. I'm Angie Quero, sitting in today for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. There's nothing quite like the moment your doctor looks at you and pronounces your diagnosis, cancer. Some people shy away, even understandable. Half of all American men and one in three women can expect to get some type of cancer diagnosis in their lifetimes. Cancer still claims the lives of one in every five American men, one in every six American women. It's the second most common cause of death after heart disease. Now, those are lousy odds. There is undeniably good news. Death by cancer has dropped dramatically by 32% since peaking in 2019. That's from the American Cancer Society. One of the chief causes is chemicals. They are all around us. The U.S. government says Americans use more than 100,000 chemicals. A new book puts the number of chemicals invented since the last century much higher than that. $300,000, and most of those are not tested. Think about that. Of all the human-made chemicals in and around you, the most widely used have no conclusive data on what they do to you and to the environment around you. That new book is A New War on Cancer, The Unlikely Heroes Revolutionizing Prevention. Christina Marusik, welcome to Your Call.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
I'm really glad to have you. Now, you would think, you know, on the face of it, death rates falling would mean that we're kind of getting a handle on things, but we're not. Many kinds of cancer are, in fact, rising in diagnosis. Tell me how that works out.
That's right. So we've gotten a lot better at treating cancer than we used to be. So our survivorship numbers are going up, which is absolutely a good thing. But we're also seeing more people get cancer, particularly for certain types of cancer. And that includes children and young adults. Over the last 50 years, we've seen a pretty dramatic increase in cancer in children and young adults around the world and here in the United States.
When I mentioned the sheer number of chemicals all around us, and even inside us, according to research, A New War on Cancer, your book, says chemical policy in this country is broken. Most of those chemicals set loose in products and the environment haven't been tested. Now, how is that? Should someone have the responsibility of testing them? Does it fall into somebody's job description?
I think there's kind of a common misconception, particularly for Americans, that if we can go to the store and buy something off the shelf, you know, it's been certified as safe somehow, that it only contains chemicals and ingredients that are safe for us. And unfortunately, that just isn't true. We have much more relaxed chemical regulations here in the United States than in many other parts of the world. And one pretty startling example is when it comes to cosmetics and personal care products. So there are at least 80 other countries that have enacted more stringent regulations on what type of chemicals can be allowed in cosmetics and personal care products than the United States has. And the European Union has banned or restricted more than 2,400 chemicals in cosmetics, while here in the US, we've only banned or restricted 9 chemicals. Mm. So oftentimes, these chemicals are being tested in other places, or if testing hasn't been completed yet, then, you know, out of precautionary principle, they're restricted or banned until they're tested and proven safe. But here in the United States, we tend to just, you know, let companies introduce new chemicals to the marketplace. And then if people get sick 20 years later, we have a class action lawsuit. And, you know, anyone who has been made sick or has lost a loved one to something like this could tell you that they would have rather had prevention than get compensation in a lawsuit like that.
Yeah, it really stands out in the book how little we spend on prevention. I mean, diagnosis and treatment, they're both very important and they both save lives, but the imbalance is really striking. You mentioned specifically in your book, while many cancer experts believe the old adage holds true, that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, that's not how we've tackled fighting cancer to date. Only 7-9% of all global funding goes toward prevention. Is anyone fighting for increased prevention funding? And why are these numbers so lopsided?
So I thank you for asking this question. I do think, you know, when we think about that 7 to 9%, if we think about that in terms of that, the war on cancer metaphor, that would be like spending 91% of our war budget on treating people who get wounded and only 9% on measures that could stop them from getting hurt in the first place, which is a crazy way to fight any war, right? And I think there are two big reasons for the kind of lopsidedness of the funding. And the first is money. So there is a lot of money to be made from investing in new treatments and a cure for cancer. When you look at market projections for the global oncology market, you know, they cite the fact that cancer rates are expected to double in the next 40 years as evidence of strong growth for the market, which is a kind of dark way of looking
Ouch,
at that.
seriously?
But
Ugh.
yeah, but you know, no one stands to get rich from cancer prevention. So we aren't going to see a solution kind of naturally emerge from the marketplace or from some entrepreneur, which means that can only be achieved through regulations. And the second reason I think the funding is so lopsided is that it's harder to advocate for prevention. It's the nature of prevention that we don't get to meet the person whose cancer we prevented, right? We don't get a big hug from a mom saying, "Thank you so much for preventing my child from getting cancer." And when you're trying to raise money for treatments and for cures, you can put the picture of a little girl or a little boy who's battling cancer on the t-shirt and on the Facebook page. And who wouldn't empathize with that and want to pitch in and help out? And then when we talk about prevention, it's often statistics and data, and it's kind of abstract, which is harder to connect with emotionally. And because of that second reason, I structured my book through profiles and stories about people who are leading this cancer prevention work, because I really wanted to try and put a face to prevention and emphasize that these are human stories too.
Yeah, I want people to listen to that title again because it is encouraging. The title of the book is A New War on Cancer: The Unlikely Heroes Revolutionizing Prevention. And Christina Marusik is on the phone with me right now. It's an optimistic title that people are hitting the ground of their own volition. And on top of that, when Joe Biden was vice president in 2016, he announced his cancer moonshot. And that plan aimed to cut the cancer death rate in the U.S. by at least 50% in the next 25 years. So talk about the funding in that plan. Where does that go?
So the new cancer moonshot is really ambitious, and there are parts of it that are really wonderful. And there's definitely a bigger focus on prevention in this version of the moonshot than there has been in previous versions of the moonshot. Historically, when that federal moonshot plan referenced prevention, it was kind of limited to early testing and early detection, which is not actually prevention, right? It's just early detection for people who already have cancer, which is very important, but is not the same as prevention. And this new cancer moonshot plan does acknowledge that prevention is important. It makes some references to chemical exposures and the role of what we're exposed to in our everyday lives. But I know that there are lots of advocates who would like to see more of that. It's kind of lacking in specifics about you know, initiatives and funding. And so the Moonshot Plan is under review right now, and there are lots of advocates who've been working on this issue for decades who are pushing to have more specific funding for prevention and more concrete plans for prevention added to the moonshot.
Well, there are some groups that maybe, as you say, there's not a lot of money in prevention. There is a lot of money to be had if you can skirt away from any existing regulations and prevent any new regulations. A lot of the chemicals come from industries and companies that create the chemicals, and then they have their say into what regulation happens there. So when we see, for example, the oil industry, you know, petrol, the byproducts, whatever, are they turning up as actively trying to dissuade politicians from regulation?
Definitely. There's a big chemical lobby in the United States. It's part of why we don't do as good a job as many other countries do at regulating these industries, because the chemical lobby is very well funded and has much more access to lawmakers here compared to what happens in somewhere like the European Union, for example. And glad you brought up oil and gas, because a lot of the chemicals that increase our cancer risk that we come into contact with on a regular basis are derived from oil and gas. And another major source of those exposures is plastics, which a lot of people don't know that 99% of plastics are made from fossil fuels. And so as the world is decarbonizing and the transportation sector is moving away from, using fossil fuels, relying on fossil fuels, that industry is turning toward plastic production increasingly to try and maintain demand for fossil fuels. So even though, we all know we're having this kind of global plastic waste crisis, we know that we have microplastics in our bodies, we know that our exposure to plastics in various forms increases our risk for lots of diseases, including cancer. The plastics industry is planning to triple plastic production by 2050. So you're right in bringing up the role of lobbyists. There absolutely is lots of lobbying going on behind the scenes, pushing for decreased regulation of these harmful chemicals, and increased ability to produce more and more of these manufactured chemicals and plastics.
I always have the same reaction when I hear this. Don't these people have children? I mean, don't they think about their own next generation? You just have to wonder about that. So let's talk about any examples you have that shows the link between certain chemicals and cancer. There are studies concluding that 2/3 of all cancer cases are linked to preventable exposures. Now, why are we not hearing more of this? Is that a matter of money as well?
I think so. There's that number might be even higher. I looked at a study by the National Institutes of Health recently that says that 90 to 95% of cancers are preventable. There are very few cancers that are only a matter of genetics. It almost always is. Even if you have a genetic predisposition to a certain type of cancer, it requires some kind of interaction with your environment in order for cancer to develop. And that includes lifestyle behaviors like the ones we always hear about when we hear about cancer prevention, including things like not smoking and diet and exercise and stress. And those things are, of course, important, but it also includes our exposure to harmful chemicals, which is something we hear a lot less about. I think, in the United States in particular, we're really told this narrative that we are individually in control of our own health, that if we make all the right choices and all the healthy choices, we can determine our health outcomes. But really, the biggest determination for health and longevity is your zip code and where you live and if you have access to clean air and clean water and healthy food to eat and a healthy environment. So a lot of what I'm trying to do with this book is say, actually our health is really dependent on the health of our communities. And some of these big picture problems are just too massive for people to solve as individual consumers. And we really need to advocate for systemic change that would make all of us safer.
This is important, and I'm glad you're listening here to Your Call. If you would like to get in on the conversation, our phone lines are open. The number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can ask your questions about cancer-causing elements, about what's happening numerically, statistically with cancer. And as we get further into the show, we'll talk about some of the very specific people, the unsung heroes, who are actually on the ground trying to make a difference. Again, the number is 866-798-8255. Let's talk, Christina, about children. It's pretty shocking to find out that one in every 285 American children receives a cancer diagnosis before the age of 20. Cancer rates for children and teens across the U.S., they're going up too, steadily over 50 years. Childhood leukemia has increased by 35%, brain cancer by 33%. Since researchers started tracking the diseases in the early 1970s, these are the numbers that they're seeing. So this upward trajectory, do you know what's been causing such a rapid increase specifically for children in the last 50 years? Or are we talking they're just going along with the adults? It's just as bad for them.
So children are more vulnerable to these chemical exposures we've been talking about than adults are. They eat more and drink more and breathe more proportionate to the size of their bodies compared to adults. So if there are harmful chemicals in their air or food or water, they're, proportionately getting more of those exposures. They're also still developing their most complex bodily systems. And those developmental processes require thousands of really precise steps to happen in specific order. And so if anything gets in that interrupts those processes, it can cause health problems, including elevated cancer risk. And because kids and babies don't have fully developed bodily systems yet, they're also not as capable at filtering out harmful substances that get into their bodies as adults are. So kids, I spoke with a number of researchers who believe that one reason for this increase we've been seeing in childhood cancer and cancer in young adults is a corresponding increase in the number of chemicals we're exposed to on a daily basis. And historically, when researchers were trying to figure out if a chemical was harmful, they usually just look at one chemical at a time and say, well, if you're only exposed to this little amount of this chemical, that doesn't look like it's enough to cause harm or cause cancer. But that fails to consider that we're not exposed to one chemical at a time in the real world in our everyday lives, where it's actually this kind of constant barrage, especially in the last 50 years as more and more manufactured chemicals have entered the marketplace, that we're exposed to many, many chemicals simultaneously. And so a couple of years ago, a group of cancer researchers from all over the world gathered to try and look at this phenomenon of these low dose exposures and see if they could figure out how they're adding up. And they found that these constant low dose exposures to these chemicals can add up in a really big way and actually be even more than additive, because chemicals combine and interact in our bodies. So exposure to one chemical plus one more chemical might not equal two, but might equal seven in terms of how much it's escalating your cancer risk. So when we're thinking about children's health, a lot of these researchers are now calling for researchers and regulators to reevaluate the way that we test chemicals for safety.
How are they being tested for safety now? The ones that are getting tested, we've already established that not enough of them are being tested. But what sort of rigor is there in the existing tests?
So it depends what kind of chemicals you're talking about. There's a class of chemicals called endocrine disrupting chemicals that disrupt our body's hormonal systems. And this category includes things like BPA, which a lot of people have heard of. It's in a lot of plastics, and it's also on receipt paper. And phthalates show up in a lot of like personal care products, shampoo. Those are both endocrine disrupting chemicals. And endocrine disrupting compounds disrupt our body's hormonal processes and are linked to lots of health effects. Researchers are still studying the link to cancer, but increasingly research suggests that they may be involved in hormone-related cancers. So things like breast cancer, testicular cancer, thyroid cancer, any cancer in a part of the body that involves hormones, it looks like these chemicals can increase risk for those types of cancers. And in the United States, the EPA was tasked with coming up with a system to test endocrine disrupting chemicals and evaluate them for safety, I think in like the 90s. And then that initiative just never got underway. It never got executed. And through the years, several health advocacy and environmental groups have sued the EPA to say, hey, you said you were going to come up with a way to test these chemicals and you never did. And courts have ordered the agency to do it. And just because of a lack of funding and a lack of staffing and a lack of political will, the agency is still really behind in figuring out a way to, screen these chemicals and try to regulate them in consumer goods. And then, we're a little bit better at certain other things. We have better regulations around some known carcinogens like formaldehyde. People are surprised to learn that asbestos actually isn't banned in the United States. The industries making asbestos sued the EPA when they tried to regulate asbestos more strictly. And they lost. The court found that the EPA didn't have the authority to do that. So we basically rely on like a voluntary actions from industries to no longer use asbestos. And then all those class action lawsuits, if you ever see a commercial that says, do you or a loved one have mesothelioma? That's the cancer that's really strongly linked to asbestos exposure. And asbestos still turns up in things like baby powder and cosmetics, because it's often contaminates talc when they're mining for talc. And we still don't have great regulations for things like that. A couple years ago, really high levels of asbestos contamination were found in Claire's makeup, which is sold like eyeshadow palettes and powder foundation. And those are marketed to very young girls, you know, tween girls. And they were found to have really high levels of asbestos. And initially when the EPA asked the company to do a recall, a voluntary recall, they declined, and they didn't fully recall the products until they got some bad press. So it depends, you know, which chemicals we're talking about. But in general, the laws that are on the books aren't very well enforced. And, you know, when it comes to testing, we're just kind of behind, you know, certainly what scientists are able to do when it comes to what our regulators are doing.
We're going to take a break here. I'm talking to Christina Marusik. The book is A New War on Cancer, The Unlikely Heroes Revolutionizing Prevention. We're talking a little bit more about the statistics when we come back, but mostly we'll be focusing on these unlikely heroes, and we will be taking your phone calls as well. Very important to the conversation. If you have experience to share, if you have questions, if you have comments about the incidence of cancer, and you know what, even if you've seen encouraging things happening around cancer, that's good to hear about. The number to call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Coming right back here in a few minutes on Your Call, I'm Angie Coiro. It's good to have you here listening to Your Call. 866-798-8255 is the phone number. If you'd like to contribute to our conversation about the new war on cancer, Christina Marusik is the author of a new book, The Unlikely Heroes Revolutionizing Prevention. Let's do get into some of those people who are moving ahead, despite what, you know, Christina, we're talking about industries that work against fighting cancer. We're talking about a lack of funding for prevention. It's kind of a relief to the brain to hear about the people who are working despite that. So I'll tell you what, let's just take potluck. Tell me who you want to start with.
Yeah, thank you for asking about that. I think it can feel really scary and overwhelming to learn about all of this. It certainly did for me when I was first finding out that, you know, we're not as safe as we generally think we are. And I found that as I met and talked to people who've devoted their lives and their careers to trying to solve this problem, it made me feel a lot more hopeful and optimistic. And so I hope that my book does that for readers too. One of the researchers I spoke with who is profiled in the book is named Ami Zoda, and she's an Indian American researcher who works at Columbia University. And her work is focused on harmful chemicals in cosmetics and personal care products. And so I talk a lot about her research in the book, which is really important and really fascinating and has been used to change legislation to make us all safer. But I also talk about, you know, her family history and how her parents immigrated to the United States, and what this means for her relationship with her daughter when she's thinking about, you know, her, what her daughter wants to use in terms of makeup and personal care products. So there are a lot of stories in addition to just, you know, talking about her research.
When you talk about, and we talked about this before the break too, is the prominence of these chemicals everywhere. I do want to go back to makeup, because it isn't strongly enough regulated. I've seen makeup reviews that people are smart enough to say, this one has talc in it, don't use that. And it's encouraging that people know such things. When you talk about regulating something like that, the people that you talked to for the book, do they have the savvy to say, this is specifically who we target for this specific thing?
So generally, so with Ami as a specific example, I was asking her, so how does this affect, what you buy and your choices at home, and what should I do differently than I am doing? And one thing that I think is important to emphasize is that I heard from Ami and lots of the other people I talked to for the book that even if you have a PhD in organic chemistry, even if you're thinking about this issue every day, these chemicals are just so ubiquitous that it's impossible to totally avoid them. And so it's not just like, I mean, there certainly are particular brands or particular products that are more likely to have harmful chemicals in them. But really, it's a much bigger problem than that. And so one of the ways, if you want to kind of reduce your overall exposure to harmful chemicals in personal care products and cosmetics, the easiest way is to go to like a third party program that verifies products as non-toxic, rather than trying to memorize ingredients and scan ingredient lists. The print is so tiny and the names are so long. And then there are also challenges with that where, for example, formaldehyde usually isn't listed as an ingredient in hair care products, but there are common ingredients in hair care products that, when they combine and are heated, release formaldehyde. And if you're applying them to your hair and then using a blow dryer or a curling iron and heat styling, that can be a problem. You're releasing formaldehyde into the air. So a couple of the programs I really like for this are the Environmental Working Group's Healthy Living app. There's a Chrome browser extension called Clearia, Clearya, that if you're shopping for products online, will pull up information about whether they contain toxic ingredients right in your browser. And there's a database called Made Safe that has a big database of products they've verified as being free of a long list of harmful ingredients. And these are all nonprofits. These organizations, are just doing this to try and help consumers be able to make safer choices, because it is so difficult to read labels. And what I have found easiest to do is, rather than throw everything out and start over, is wait until I'm about to run out of something and then use that as an opportunity to treat myself to a non-toxic upgrade. So if I'm about to run out of mascara, I'll just go into one of those apps or programs, type in mascara, find one that's been verified as free from a long list of potentially harmful ingredients, and pick one that way. And that makes it a lot, less overwhelming, I think, to take a kind of gradual approach.
Yeah, it makes more sense. I want to walk back the way I asked you that question. I asked if these people who work so hard have the savvy to do so and so. And of course they do. This is not a question of whether these people are smart. They're not only smart, they're motivated, they're passionate, and they're doing the work that benefits all of us. So I just wanted to get rid of that word that I threw out there. Let's talk about Melanie Mead and her work.
Melanie Mead is a grassroots clean air activist who lives in Clairton, Pennsylvania, which is really close to where I live in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And her town is home to a U.S. Steel coke plant that makes coke, which is a key ingredient in steel making. And coke is made by heating coal to extraordinarily high temperatures. And so the emissions, as you can imagine, are very, very carcinogenic. And the coke plant that's in Clairton is one of the oldest in the country. It's definitely the largest in the United States that's still operating. And the company regularly exceeds clean air laws. It's constantly getting fined. They're regularly getting sued by residents and environmental groups. But I think generally it has just been cheaper for them to pay those fines and pay out those lawsuits than it would be to kind of update the equipment, because it's so old. And so as a result, Clairton, where Melanie Mead lives, often has some of the dirtiest air in the United States. And Melanie grew up in Clairton. Her family farmed that land for generations long before the steel plant came to town. And over like an 8-year period, Melanie was one of four kids, and she lost every single member of her family to either cancer or respiratory disease, or heart disease. So she lost her mom and her dad within a 6-month period, and then all three of her siblings. And she's now the only person left in her immediate family. She still lives in the house she grew up in with all her siblings, which was her grandparents' house before that. And she is determined to stay and fight for clean air in the community. You know, she gets asked kind of all the time, why don't you just leave? And she really feels a connection to this community. It's where her family history is. It's where her people are. So she doesn't want to leave. And she has spent the last 10 years or so working as an activist. I met her. I'm an investigative reporter, and I met her at a press conference about air pollution, where she was begging regulators to do more to protect the community from dirty air. And I included her story in the book because I think her resilience is so inspiring, and also because I know that there are Melanie Meads all over the country and throughout the world who are up against these really huge corporations and impossible odds and have endured tremendous injustice, but they stay and they fight for the health of their communities.
You're listening to Your Call. I'm Angie Cuero, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today. I'll be with you on Monday, too. We're going to be discussing plastics and recycling, so related topic. Be sure to come back for that. We're taking your calls at 866-798-8255 as we discuss the new book, A New War on Cancer, The Unlikely Heroes Revolutionizing Prevention. Christina, I know that when you are living in an area where one particular industry employs almost everyone there, there's a lot of kickback when you try to take that industry on. And I wondered, with all the people you talked to, those who made the book and those who may not have made the book, are they, as well as working against specific industries and political forces, are they also having to deal with neighbors who are saying, what are you doing to my job here?
That's definitely something that comes up for Melanie Mead. She expressed a lot of frustration about, trying to kind of rally the community to join her in protests and in calling for more stringent regulations, and getting a lot of pushback because, so many people depend on the plant for work. And actually, she told me that all of the men in her family and some of the women worked at the plant at some point in their lives, either for entire careers or for summer jobs. The mayor of Clairton has had cancer twice and, has also worked for U.S. Steel for 30 years and maintains that, his health issues have nothing to do with the pollution and that the company is great and is a great employer. So that's absolutely something that comes up. That comes up, I'm here in Western Pennsylvania, so I report a lot on fracking and people who are neighbors to the fracking industry. And I write about that a little in the book. It comes up in that context too. And I think, in this region in particular that has this long history of extractive industries coming in and generally making big promises about jobs and prosperity, and then kind of actually extracting lots of wealth and resources and leaving environmental problems in their wake without benefiting communities a whole lot. People have been really conditioned into this mindset that it's important for them to make sacrifices on behalf of American good, right? That we need energy independence, we need steel, we all depend on these resources, and that if they're making sacrifices, it's for this kind of greater patriotic good. But actually, U.S. Steel is a private corporation, and the people at the top are making millions of dollars in profits, and the community in Clairton is seeing very little of that.
Mm. Let's talk about your own family experiences, because you mentioned that you grew up in Pittsburgh, and that is just a serious air pollution problem there. So your dad, your sister, your husband's family, they've all dealt with cancer, and your husband has an autoimmune disease as well. How rare is your family to have be in that region and have so many members affected?
That's pretty typical for this region. I hear from lots of people who, have multiple family members who have autoimmune disorders, multiple family members who have gone through cancer. My sister was diagnosed with thyroid cancer when she was 25, which is very young for a cancer diagnosis. Mm. And so she is, among those younger and younger people who are increasingly getting cancer. And my sister is doing well. She's in remission, been in remission for 10 years. She has two super cute kids who I love being an aunt to. But I know that my sister, you know, like any other cancer survivor, will tell you that she would have rather had prevention than a cure if it was an option.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go to the phone lines, and we're going to talk first to Trudy, who's in San Francisco. Trudy, thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to mention a local group who are real champions of the cause. They're called Breast Cancer Prevention Partners. Mm-hmm. And not only do they provide a lot of education about this topic, but they've really rolled up their sleeves and they've agitated and created legislation in California. They're behind the biomonitoring project that goes on in this state, where they've done studies, research studies, and so on, to track how much of what chemicals are building up in people's bodies, different groups, and so on. And just a wonderful organization.
And that is the Breast Cancer Prevention Project?
Breast Cancer Prevention Partners.
Partners, yeah. Okay. Thank you so much. We're going to get that link and put that up on our website at klw.org. Just look for your call and click on that. And we do have other calls to get to, so let me, in my clever way, figure out who's on which line, and we're going to have another call in just a moment here. But, you know, you had mentioned earlier that race and class and even just your geographic location have a lot to do with cancer rates. And there's just some new, this just came out September 11th from the NIH, and the researchers there combined historical air quality with breast cancer data from a large study. And they found if you live in an area with high levels of particulate, you are going to be looking at an increased incidence of breast cancer. To use the official words, it is associated with. So that's not a cut and dried cause. But it's consistent with earlier studies that have found, for example, people of color who live along freeways, because, you know, that's what they can afford, or that's where, you know, in the effects of old redlining, that's where they are historically. They have higher rates of cancer. They have higher rates of respiratory problems. And we're seeing class and color play out with that in many areas across the country.
That's right. And I think it's important to mention, you know, you said that study found an association. And whenever we're talking about studies that happen in the real world, and specifically studies related to pollution, those are the only kinds of studies we have access to, because it's not ethical for us to intentionally dose people with high levels of air pollution and then see if they develop cancer, right? We can't do that in a lab. And so any study that looks at the real world, it has to acknowledge that, you know, people are exposed to lots of things and we can't control for them. But I think that's important for people to know. Sometimes the industry, when they're fighting these kinds of studies, will say, well, that's not a definitive link because, you know, who knows what else they were exposed to. But I do think it's important to know that that's kind of how all epidemiological studies have to work, because we can't intentionally dose people with pollution. But to get back to your main point, I think it's, you know, kind of common knowledge at this point that low income communities of color experience disproportionate levels of pollution. But this definitely goes beyond that. You mentioned redlining and other historic practices that have kind of led to these disparities. And studies have also shown that Black Americans, for example, buy more personal care products that contain cancer-causing chemicals. And this is particularly true for products that are designed to kind of help achieve white beauty standards like hair relaxers and skin lighteners. Skin lighteners are less popular in the United States, but they're very popular like throughout Southeast Asia. And so researchers like Ami Zoda are calling on people who look at these health disparities to say, you know, you really need to look beyond just water contamination and air pollution to how do race and gender impact what personal care products we use and the toxicity of those products. So I think there's a big movement in environmental health to take a more intersectional approach to these questions.
I do want to get to some of the preventive measures that we can take if we're not going to be assisted by industry. At least we can try to help ourselves. At mindbodygreen.com, you published 5 simple ways to avoid exposure to cancer-causing chemicals in your home. And the one that really stood out to me, we'll get into all of them, but the one that really stood out to me is stop heating food in plastic. And the reason that stood out, it was either Wired or Vox that came out with a story that was headlined, "For the love of God, stop heating food in plastic." So you're not alone in that one. But you know, we have plastic microwave covers. We have microwavable Tupperware. It's everywhere that you see people heating in plastic.
Yeah, I think it's important to know that when something says it's microwave safe, that just means that that isn't going to melt. That just means that it's going to maintain its structural integrity in the microwave. It's not going to melt or fall apart. That does not mean that it's been tested for human health and safety. So the concern with heating plastic is that plastics, there are over 10,000 chemicals used in plastics manufacturing. Many of them have not been tested for safety. Scientists took a big look at this a couple years ago, and they said that at least a quarter of those chemicals that are used in plastics manufacturing can pose some kind of threat to our health or to like aquatic life in the environment. So we don't want the chemicals in plastic leaching into our food. And that can happen when you heat food in plastic. So I've really tried to switch over to just using, you know, glass containers or ceramic dishes to heat things in the microwave rather than plastic containers.
Makes sense. We've already talked about how to stay away from toxic cosmetics and personal care products. So let's jump over to eating organically. And again, there can be issues of class and money here. Eating organic is eating more expensively, but you can make the case that if it is money you can prioritize, it's a good thing to do.
There's been some research that shows that when people switched from a conventional diet to an organic diet, they did have measurably lower levels of pesticides in their bodies. So we have some good scientific evidence that, you know, eating organic reduces the number of pesticides we're exposed to. And pesticide regulation is another place where, unfortunately, the United States is behind much of the rest of the world. We use many pesticides to grow food here that are banned in many other parts of the world because of concerns about health, including cancer risk. So when it's accessible, I try to emphasize that none of this is about being perfect. Mm-hmm. It's always just about what is available to you, where you can take some big swings and kind of reduce your overall exposure, because it's just not possible to be, you know, so meticulous, so perfect that you don't have any exposure. So it's just what is easy, what is available. So if you have access to organic food, that's one good way to kind of reduce your overall exposure to pesticides.
And with that, we're going to go back to the phones. Raleigh in San Francisco has been waiting. Raleigh, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I'm in Oakland, actually.
But, okay.
I worked at Edgar Thompson Works for a few years, which is the mill close to Clairton. She was discussing Clairton, the Coke Works, which we felt all the way up the river. There are three rivers there in near Pittsburgh. Anyway, I wanted to say that I was an activist, and I thought the most useful approach to talking about the environmental pollution wasn't about protecting the individual workers. There was kind of a culture, a macho culture in the mill where, you know, we take care of ourselves. The mill was self-insured, so rarely did it report the harm that was causing to the workers. If you were hurt on the job, you were just kept there, and there was no real record of your injury. But the most effective thing was to say, talk about your family. And saying, are your kids safe? And they weren't. And I just wanted to say that in a situation where you are trapped and you appear to be threatening jobs, or they make it seem that way, the most successful approach I had in trying to get people to change things was say, we're looking out for our families. Look at what they're breathing. Anyway, I just wanted to say thank you for the show.
Oh, and thank you for that insight. I appreciate it very much. That was Raleigh in Oakland. And did you want to comment on that, Christina?
Yeah, that's really great advice. I think that's a smart approach. I also, I can actually see the Edgar Thompson Works from my backyard. So it's very cool to hear from someone who is now in Oakland, who used to be right here in my neighborhood. And I appreciate that advice.
We're going to talk about the last two hints you had about trying to stay away from chemicals, and that is investing in a good water filter and filtering your air as well. A lot of us learned about filtering air during the fires, And that's when it was right in front of our faces. The sky was orange. You could smell it. But it would seem like a smart thing to do to remind yourself that even when you can't see it and smell it, it's a good idea to be filtering your air.
Yeah, periodically filtering the air in your house is another kind of easy way to take a big swing at lowering your family's overall exposure, especially, you know, in winter months when it's cooler and we all kind of keep our houses sealed up. Outdoor pollution can make its way in. And then we also have indoor pollutants from, you know, aerosol sprays and cleaning products. And if you have a gas stove, the combustion from your gas stove releases volatile organic compounds like benzene into the air. So filtering your indoor air periodically is